to item three, the main attraction, which is our review of total portfolio performance for the period ending June 30, 2025, otherwise known as Q2. Good morning.
Good morning.
Scott and Danny, nice to see you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Twice in 2 weeks.
Yeah. I heard you guys had quite the train ride after you left us the other day.
It's a slow process. And I learned that that high heat affects the tracks.
That's what I
and makes the
too.
Train stop.
I heard
we learned that too.
Interesting. Anyway, well, hopefully it wasn't too bad.
No.
So as we typically do, we're going to spend just a little bit of time on the market environment. Danny's going to cover that before I jump into performance.
So Danny, take it away.
All right. I'll do the clicker and then pass it over. Thank you, Scott.
Hey, pull it, if you would, Danny. Just pull it. Yeah, there you go. Just
perfect. I'll speak up here, too. All right. So I'll provide you an update on the quarterly investment landscape and then talk a little bit about some of the things that have happened in July and August subsequent to the second quarter. I think the big story for second quarter was really a story of resilience amidst a lot of uncertainty. So if you go back to the second quarter, it started in April with the Liberation Day event, right? And so we had all this uncertainty surrounding all these additional tariffs that were going to be coming through the economy and being applied to different trading partners. There was a lot of market volatility around that event. And then we ended the quarter, we ended the second quarter with the U.S. bombing Iran's nuclear facilities. So this was a big quarter, a lot of stuff was happening, and a lot of uncertainty throughout the economy and just general politics. But what we saw was the economy was incredibly resilient and markets were resilient. So real GDP beat expectations in the second quarter, came in at 3% quarter over quarter. That gave market participants a lot of confidence that, you know, this economy really is humming along. Even though there's all these things happening, it's really been quite strong and really quite robust. Inflation does remain sticky, right? So the Fed is targeting a 2% inflation rate. And we saw it go from 2.4% up to 2.7% in the quarter. So it has been somewhat sticky, but by and large, you know, inflation has come down a lot from where we were in the last year or two. If you look at one of the big things, one of the big parts of uncertainty in the market today, it's how these tariffs are going to flow through to consumers or flow through into these economic numbers. The way that we don't really know exactly how this is going to work out yet, but if businesses decide to eat some of these costs, these increased costs, then what we're going to see is that's going to have an impact on earnings in subsequent months and quarters. And that'll actually help the inflation numbers, right? However, if they decide to pass this on to consumers, we're going to see that flow through into the inflation numbers. We don't know for sure exactly how this is going to work out, yet to be seen. We kind of have some numbers that kind of give us hints of what we've seen so far, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But that's a big area of uncertainty for us right now. Just step back. I think it's really important to step back and look at where we're at. The numbers are really strong. Our research team yesterday put out a piece looking at where we're at with some of the major metrics relative to a 20-year history. And if you look at inflation, we're at our 20-year average. If you look at GDP growth, we're at our 20-year average. And if you look at unemployment, we're below our 20-year average. So in the long-term span of things, things are actually quite strong right now, and things look pretty good. Jump forward here, talk a little bit about inflation. So we've seen inflation be sticky. This is one of the tenets of the Fed's dual mandate, right, which is maximum employment and price stability. So this gets at the price stability component. And inflation does remain somewhat a mixed picture. So we've seen it kind of come down from its I'll just move on to this one. If you see from where we were in 2022, it's come down significantly. But it kind of has stalled out a little bit right here, and we haven't gotten down to that 2% target that the Fed is looking to get. And more recently, we've seen a couple of prints that are a little bit concerning. Core CPI increased recently up to 3.1%, so that strips out food and energy from the CPI. We also saw a producer price index in July that came out hotter than expected. But by and large, looking at this trend, it's been coming down pretty smooth. There's a little bit of concern in some of the recent numbers, but I think by and large, this is really good news. Let me move on here to the other aspect of the Fed's dual mandate, the labor market. So most aspects of the labor market continue to suggest that things are incredibly strong, really strong conditions. We see unemployment, like I said at the onset, it's at, you know, the 20-year average. We continue to see jobs reports that are really strong, with the exception of what we saw in July. We did have a number come out, a non-farm payroll number at 73,000 new jobs added, and that was actually quite bad. But the more concerning thing is following that number, the administration came out and said that those numbers were rigged and that they were fake. And then the Bureau of Labor Statistics commissioner was actually fired. So that's a more concerning thing than the actual print to me. But what we've seen over and over again is the markets continue to be resilient. We have this blip. It's concerning what came out of that in terms of somebody being fired for it. It's an independent organization, so it's not a political organization that's coming up with these numbers.
And what resource do you go to when people are getting fired for posting, you know, bad numbers and so forth? I mean, you rely on that information. So in that context, where do you go for your source of information then?
So they fired this commissioner. It's still a machine. The organization that produces these numbers is a machine. So there will be somebody that steps up and applies the same principles. I see you being, we hope, right?
So far we have confidence in the numbers, right? Yeah. It's not like one person at the head of an organization can actually change the numbers, because it's a process that has so many inputs and so many different fingers creating those numbers. And so we remain confident that the numbers coming out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics are good quality numbers. As you're probably aware, it's sort of the gold standard internationally in terms of data integrity. And we think that that data integrity will persist. As Danny and I were talking about this morning, it's kind of the first couple of steps on that. You just wonder if it's going to continue or not. But so far, we remain confident that in the data integrity of the statistics that are coming out of that.
Yeah, but the degree of fear in that organization from, you know, not wanting to give bad news kind of thing, that's going to impact the report. I mean, it is a process and so forth, but who's going to deliver the news, and is that going to be tainted in any way?
Right.
And
that's
I mean, your degree of confidence in that information has to be diluted a little bit there.
Yeah, and I think there's a really bright light shining on it right now. So everybody's paying attention to that. So any numbers in the future are going to be scrutinized from both sides. But I agree with you that there's been pressure and it could have negative impact. I think our hope is that it's a big enough machine and there's a robust enough process behind it that this action doesn't cause
That's
numbers to be changed based
time.
On it.
But are there other resources that you're able to utilize to get to kind of check the information that you're getting post-firing?
Not on those particular statistics, but
yeah.
It is sort of a, you know, it's an overall tapestry of information that's coming in that we're always looking at different metrics to sort of corroborate and confirm the metrics that we see in any event.
And a lot of these metrics are closely related too. So, you know, if one thing is changing, it's something else is changing somewhere else, right? So, well, good question. It is certainly a concern.
Yeah, turn your mic. Mic's on now.
To the Bureau of Labor Statistics data that comes out. Yeah,
right. Correct.
Because I mean, there's other. There are other. Like there's surveys that come out in the private sector that you would expect would corroborate that over time, but it's not like the Bureau of Labor Statistics. There's no additional source of data like that.
Because the other concerning thing is the current nominee for the replacement is calling for the suspension of monthly reporting, even though the BLS is mandated to report on a monthly basis. So if all norms are out off the table, then what happens to the system when even the routine monthly numbers aren't reported in a timely manner?
To be seen. We're keeping a close eye on it.
Danny, can you go back to unemployment or the labor market? I'm sorry. So in the graph to the right, you have the border encounters. And so that's like practically nobody now. and I think a lot of those numbers are those who have presented themselves to the border who are seeking asylum, mm-hmm. and applying for temporary work visas while the process is going on. And the concern that I've heard recently at NASRA and NCPERS is that so agriculture is like 42% of the labor force there is impacted by this, and then construction and hospitality. And do you have any comments on that and what we need to pay attention to as a board with some of our investments on how that might be impacted?
We haven't really seen a big obvious impact on agriculture yet that I'm aware of that's come out of our research team. It's something that they're paying attention to. My understanding is that there's been some relief from the administration on farmers and agriculture in terms of, you know, trying to ease the labor burden. And I don't know how that's playing out or how it will play out, but so far we haven't seen a big impact. It seems sort of inevitable, right, if you think about it.
Yeah, I understand in South Florida it's quite a quite a real impact with respect to construction.
Mm-hmm.
And I would assume in other markets too.
GDC.
John? One last thought on the labor statistics. Mr. Trump does have a way of taking a sledgehammer to virtually every issue. You know, if it's an ant, we can kill it with a tank if we want to. But I saw some interesting stuff afterwards when they were talking about the labor statistics. It was later on, after people were all done talking about the end of the world and as we know it, they did seem to acknowledge that there probably should be some changes in the method of gathering the data. That a lot of the data was coming in a lot more slowly in years past. They were using archaic methods to do it. It was surveys, written surveys by companies. They did acknowledge there was a way, there were probably better ways or more refined ways to gather the data. And they even said that the fact that so many of these methods were archaic led inordinately to the number of restatements that are done.
Revisions.
Every single quarter or month is restated after they get more data. So again, he has a bizarre way of pointing to some of these things, but I wonder if this is Bureau to look to getting themselves up to speed and gathering more useful information and getting it out faster.
Adjusting the process to be more efficient.
Yeah, and hopefully more accurate.
More accurate.
Yeah, so I'm not saying the numbers were fixed. I don't buy that. But it's just that it looks as if it's more of a garbage in, garbage out. They're getting data that is not reliable or is not timely. And so they put out the best numbers they can with, in some cases, unreliable and late data. And what you get out of that is questionable results.
The level of the revision was really interesting. Right? The
I don't think they'd seen that level of revision historically ever. So that was curious and maybe part of the issue that you're addressing.
All right, if there are no further questions, let's keep going.
All right, so move on to...
And Candace, any time if you have a question, just, you know, I can't see you, so just let me know.
So here, I just want to hit on the Fed. So the most recent meeting on July 30th, the Fed, as we know, probably decided to keep the benchmark interest rate unchanged. I think the more important thing here, so we've had a lot of noise, again, from the administration pressuring the Fed to lower interest rates. But the thing that was really interesting in the last Fed meeting is there were two members of the committee. They vote, right? The committee votes to what they want to do with interest rates. There were two members of the committee who dissented from the rest and voted to cut interest rates. And the last time that happened was 1993. So it's been over 30 years since there's been members of the Fed who have dissented on a vote with the rest. So I think that we're kind of getting to this precipice with the Fed in terms of acting and in terms of potentially starting to think about cutting interest rates. And there is an important event this week. Powell's going to be at Jackson Hole this Friday. And I think hopefully we're going to get some clarity there. I think he clearly is being pressured. He sees the same data as everybody else. There's good arguments at this point to be cutting interest rates. He continues to want to take this wait-and-see approach. But I think just to see that there's a couple members of the committee who have dissented is quite important at this point in time, especially since it hasn't happened in over 30 years. So those are kind of the big things that we saw throughout the quarter. There was a lot of stuff going on. There was a lot of uncertainty. We can pick some pieces that were more concerning in some of the data, but by and large, what we see is a really robust economy. Markets did extremely well, and anything that was down during the first part of the second quarter really bounced back towards the end. So with that, I'm going to stop and see if there's any other questions. If not, Scott will go into performance.
Any other questions for Dan or Scott Sampson?
Speaking of the Fed rates, what's the market pricing in? Are we expecting a quarter, half a point?
I think right now it's between 1 to 2, maybe 3, but I think it's right around there.
The last statistic I heard was there's a 95% chance of a quarter point cut, and I don't know what a 50 basis point cut is, but something quite a bit less than that. But a strong possibility of at least one cut.
Okay. And then how many for the rest of the year?
So that's what I was
just
talking about.
Just the one?
Yeah, just the one.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so moving to performance, and if you look at the portfolio reconciliation page on slide 50 of the deck, you can really see what Danny was talking about in terms of the overall quarter and the performance. So April was awful, but the market came back strong in May and June, and you can see the table on the top portion of this page. You started the quarter with $11.7 billion net cash flow of negative net cash flow of $122 million. Net investment change of $655 million, taking you above $12 billion ending the quarter. On the next slide, I just want to point out something of interest. Some members of the evaluation team came to our Seattle office. We had our actuary come in and talk about some work that we're doing with plans that are anticipating a contribution cliff at some point out in the future. You guys aren't in particularly bad shape with respect to a contribution cliff, but in out near 2040, there is sort of a meaningful drop in contributions based on actuarial projections. And so it is still quite a ways out into the distance, but it's never too soon to start thinking about that stuff, especially given the level of private markets
investments that you have in your portfolio that are liquidity sensitive. And so we're doing some work now with a couple of plans that I think would will be beneficial to you all at some point in the future. And you can sort of see that on the chart on the left-hand portion of the page with that slowly increasing net negative cash flow. On the next slide, we show your allocation versus the policy targets. We look at the current target, and we've added in the long-term target as well, just to give you another point of reference there relative to your long-term strategic asset allocation. And from a fiduciary perspective, you can see that you are within the ranges. And then we get to performance on the next slide, and the quarterly performance was 5.7% on a gross of fee basis. This is net of fees. You can see 5.6% here relative to your implementation benchmark of 5 percentage points. One thing that's worth pointing out is the, we like to show the correlation in the text between the growth and the diversifying portfolios to see the diversification benefit. Interestingly, so 0.52, 0.58, and 0.51 over the 1, 3, and 5 year periods, respectively, still higher than we would like to see and not quite the diversification benefit that we would expect to see or like to see, but that's quite a bit better than it was a year ago when the 1 year number was running 0.8. So diversification benefit possibly improving from some of the changes that have been made in the portfolio. And then moving to,
But you would expect that, right?
Yes. It,
that's the reason the changes were in fact
exactly
made. Okay.
Yeah. Moving to detailed performance, a few things to note here. So here you can see gross of fees, and we show that so we can show the rankings for the managers relative to universe of similar managers, and in all parts of the portfolio contributed. So it was a good quarter for your portfolio in particular. The only thing that didn't really work is something that has been a frustration, and that is that private markets continued to underperform public markets. And when, you know, the Mag 7 and the S&P is ripping in a non-diversified portfolio is really where you want to be, the private markets continue to underperform the public markets. And we're seeing green shoots now with the IPO market sort of loosening up and liquidity coming back into the market. So there's we're seeing a little bit more in the way of exits. So if that trend continues, we would expect then the private market portfolio to be more of a contributor to your overall portfolio.
But Scott, is it with the private markets, are you speaking specifically about private equity, or private credit is still doing fine, right?
Yeah, private credit is actually contributing pretty well to your portfolio.
Yeah, so it's mainly private equity.
Yes.
And one of the major factors for that is the exit issues.
Yep, interest rates, exits, and we'll touch on that in just a bit, a little more. So interestingly, in your growth portfolio, some of your public markets managers had some non-performance related issues that came up that I just want you to be aware of. Usually we don't see this level of qualitative things, but there were 4 managers that had some stuff that came up. Nothing of concern, but just for your information and awareness. You had, if you look on page 56, Boston Partners. Mark Donovan is the portfolio manager there. He's retiring. So this is really well communicated. It's been planned quite a bit in advance. He's going to be leaving April 2026. He's got 2 co-portfolio managers that he's been working with for a long time that are will be taking over, and so no concerns there. But just that level of organizational change wanted you to be aware of. And then on the next slide, your emerging markets manager, PIMCO, Research Affiliates Emerging Markets. They're unfortunately the one of the portfolio managers there, Chris Brightman, had some health issues. And so they announced that he would be taking a leave of absence. And they put it in terms of order of magnitude on months and not weeks. So I presume that it's pretty serious. The thing that gives us comfort there is he was more of an operational portfolio manager. This is a quantitative strategy, so it's not like
who's in there evaluating companies and picking stocks. It's a systematic strategy that it will just continue to run on its own, and they have a quant team that manages that and makes adjustments that is not being impacted. Your other emerging markets manager, interestingly, has a third-party data provider that had a security breach. They were really forthcoming and really good in getting information out quickly to folks like us and your team to make sure that we knew that they were on top of it and that it was not going to impact the portfolio management process. It was around real-time market data, so volume and pricing of securities. They initiated their disaster recovery program and continued to operate smoothly, so we were pleased to see that. And then lastly, First Eagle, another thing that we've known for a while is a private equity manager was coming in and buying a majority stake from another private equity manager. This was announced back in March, and they just closed that last week, I think. So all those things don't typically come up on a quarter-over-quarter basis, but I just wanted to bring those to your attention to make sure that you knew that they were happening and that we are comfortable with all of them. A couple of the performance things that might be of interest on this same page. One is TT. I know that's been an area of concern. And you may be pleased to see that they outperformed in the month quite handily and on a relative and absolute basis. You can see about two-thirds of the way down the page for the three-month period, 13% versus 12%. The concern came from that year-to-date number where they had a period of underperformance. Previously, you can see the long-term since inception, they're still sort of above average, and our research team still has strong conviction with this manager. Moving to the next slide, I will point out that the very top of the page, that private credit return that Dr. McDonald referred to, 5.2%, a good return relative to public markets and contributing to the portfolio. Longer-term performance in private credit has been strong. And then if you look down the private equity, the second to last line on this page, you can see there the 3 months, 1 year, going back in time, 3 years, 0.5%, so quite a bit lower than the public markets, right, which has been a drag on the overall performance of the portfolio. You look over to the right, and you got to go all the way back to 2021, where they just had some spectacular returns coming out of COVID at 60.4%. It's been an uphill climb since then. As I mentioned, sort of green shoots we're seeing now. In fact, our director, the head of our private markets team, was quoted in CIO Magazine talking about sort of the IPO market loosening up a little and some liquidity coming back into the market.
What's the next best exit strategy beyond IPO?
So there's secondaries where the secondary market has really sort of exploded and become much more mature over the last 5 years or so, maybe even 10 years, where sellers with maturing funds can go to the secondary market and sell positions at a modest discount. There's also a relatively new mechanism that's come up, extension funds, where they'll sell assets from a current fund into another fund that they also manage. There were some concerns about that when they first started up in terms of potential conflicts of interest and maybe the GPs getting a benefit over the LPs, but I think largely those have been worked through, and continuation funds are now a reasonable way to get liquidity in a fund. So those are sort of the three primary ways.
Okay, thank you.
And also strategic acquisitions, I would say, is even more prevalent than IPOs. And the last thing that I will point out is in the liquidity fund. This has just been a good, strong workhorse. You can look across the top row there, the one-year number at 6.3%. Good contribution to the portfolio
relative to its custom benchmark and on an absolute basis as well. So the liquidity portfolio has been a good contributor and kept up its end of the bargain. So with that, I will conclude my comments if there's any questions.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Are there...
The Fed becomes more aggressive at lowering rates. How is that going to impact our fixed income?
So it will be positive for your fixed income holdings, your public fixed income holdings, your private fixed income holdings, which are variable rate investments. It will bring down the future expected return of those. Importantly, it will also have a positive effect on your private equity as rates come down.
Hold on one second, folks. Excuse me. We're going to take a short break. Think about 5 minutes, and then we'll report back. Thanks. All right. I think we've got everybody back for the moment. Candace, can you hear me okay?
I hear you very well. Thanks so much.
To reconvene our meeting after our pause, it's about 10:09, and we will reconvene our regular meeting. We are going to pick up where we left off, which is at item 3B, following our presentation from Vera. So, Tim, let me turn the floor over to you for the report on 3B.
Sure, and we'll move through this fairly quickly here because I think Vera's covered most of the material. I think is highly noteworthy. We're going to start on page 2 of the staff, or page 3 of the staff report, with the report card with the greens and the beige, I guess we're going to call that. Just a quick recap. Liquidity program continues. I like the way Scott put it. It's the workhorse of the portfolio. It's working hard right now. We're getting about between 5% and 7% 1 year returns on that. So I certainly think we've been the beneficiary of the lower rate environment, of the higher rate environment on this shorter duration portfolio. Growth, while it's meeting its absolute return targets at 9.7%. We continue to hear see the story of the private equity not being the contributor in the short to medium term that we expect it to be. And so that's where we see the 4% relative underperformance to ACWI, which is a broad publicly traded benchmark. And then the risk diversifying, our number metrics here over 5 years, the recent changes that we've made to that portfolio and the changes that we're making prospectively to that portfolio are going to take some time to show up in the database and in the report card here. So if we go to page 4 then, the liquidity, I'm just going to highlight the fact that, we have those nice, strong one-year returns. But if you take a look at the current yields, also elevated, that's the best predictor of future returns for a portfolio like this. So I think we're in a good position here. We're getting paid on short-duration assets, and we expect to get paid on short-duration assets over the next year as well. And we'll watch the rate environment quite closely, but I think a rate environment that is steady or declining is going to be beneficial for this portion of the portfolio. If we then go to slide 7 on the growth portfolio, I just want to highlight, we saw the equity markets rebound in the second quarter. You see that show up in the one-year numbers here. Obviously, strong global markets with 16% over the past year on MSCI ACWI. The domestic markets largely keeping up. I think the nice thing to see here is where international equity and emerging market equity had been laggards relative to U.S. equity. That gap has started to close over the past year, really. And a lot of that is the impact on the dollar. So we've seen a lot of the turmoil that we thought was going to come from the geopolitical angles and the tariffs and the trade wars and that sort of thing to show up in the U.S. markets hasn't really shown up in the U.S. markets. It's shown up in the dollar. So that declining dollar strength, when we take a look at overseas earnings then get inflated by the because we're coming back into a weaker dollar there. We're happy to see those returns. We are in the process of rebalancing the portfolio and taking some of those gains right now. The other thing I want to highlight here is, you know, private equity, it's been our punching bag, and we expect it to outperform the public markets, and it's not doing that. But it is performing, you know, 6% over the past year, 13% over the past 5 years. These are numbers that are not, the 5 and 10 year numbers are closer to in keeping with expectations. The 1 year number coming back a bit. You know, I do think that it's important to recognize that when the IPO market does fully reopen, we have a lot of companies queued up and ready to go. One of our portfolios just had one of the most successful IPOs 2 weeks ago. A company called Firefly went public. It was a 10x return. It returned the bulk of the fund with that one return. It was an AE Industrial fund. And so we are certainly seeing segments of the market come back here, particularly in space-related and in some of the biotechs. We're waiting to see the financial markets fully reopen, the financial sector fully reopen in the IPO market.
Can I have a question? Just real fast. When a private company goes public, right, with IPO, do we keep stake there or we usually divest?
Typically, our managers have to keep the publicly traded securities for a lockup period of 6 to 12 months. Almost always, they will then liquidate over, you know, what they think is a prudent period of time and return cash to us. A couple of venture capital funds typically return securities to us, and then we liquidate the securities. But it's almost always a cash return, and we have a preference for the cash return just because it's fungible and we can redeploy it as needed. Yep. Varis was kind enough to update a number of personnel changes. There's only two more I would highlight there, and that's you know, what we highlighted in the past quarter with William Blair. We have the CEO of the firm retiring next year or end of this year, and one of our three portfolio managers retiring in early in 2026. We've met with the remaining team. So the remaining team, Simon Fennell has been on this portfolio for almost as long as we've had the account. We know him very well. We're building up our knowledge with the other portfolio manager, Andy Siefker. We met with him in July in Chicago. So I wouldn't say all is fine, but we're watching that process closely. Early indications look like it's going to be okay. They've telegraphed the retirements well in advance.
For all of the events that transpired that we've talked about that affect managers, did we get the proper notification or did we learn it some other way?
No, we've gotten the proper notification on all these. And I think, you know, particularly with William Blair and with Boston Partners, they're telegraphing this close to a year out in advance.
Right.
This is exactly what we want to see. You built the team. You have the redundancies on that portfolio management team. We've gotten to know second and third generation, and we're ready for that turnover. We haven't had a surprise or a shorter than desired notification really for a couple of years here. I think folks have done a good job of getting ahead of this for the most part.
That's good. Thank you.
The last one I want to highlight is it's embedded within our real estate portfolio here, but we have real estate commitments with Blackstone. I know you recall about a month ago there was a shooting at the Blackstone offices in New York City. One member of the investment committee for real estate was a partner who was killed in the lobby of that building. So Wesley LePatner died in that attack at the office there. She was a member of the investment committee. It's a 30-person investment committee. They're going to continue the investment committee kind of with the remaining members there. But that was an indirect impact to our portfolio. So then if we turn to diversifying, I would just say quickly, the AFL-CIO and SIT LLCAR had good absolute return years. BHDG trend following is in a tough spot here. The entire segment's in a tough spot. We continue to have close contact with them and we're drawing on the resources of Varis as well. Subsequent to the end of the quarter, we did add the first treasury allocation to this portfolio. So you'll see that show up in the third quarter report. So continuing to build that out. And I was going to introduce my new team member, Kat Zhang. She's in a meeting right now, but Kat comes to us from Atos. It's a hedge fund of funds on the peninsula. She's got deep experience in that space, and she's already starting to build up some ideas there, so we've got some more horsepower to support that portfolio going forward. She's working. She had a 10 o'clock
meeting. She's working.
So you're working on the ideas. There we go.
Tim?
Yes.
The on page 9, when you look at AFFL's CIO, it's just, you know, 5 years to date is minus 1%. So it's like, is this, where do we stand on we don't do watch things anymore, but yeah. This is, so let me, 5 years is a trend.
No, let's put that in context. So this is an intermediate duration fixed income. So certainly the rise of rates took out that intermediate duration fixed income portion of the portfolio. I think relative to the aggregate benchmark, you know, we're seeing kind of, you know, close results there. I think there was certainly a collective acknowledgement about 2 years ago that we had an over-reliance on fixed income in this portion of the portfolio. We need to diversify away from that, but this is part of that fixed income piece that's still an element of what we do in that space, but we know we got to diversify beyond that. But I think the story there is the rate hikes really took the knees out of intermediate duration, so 6 to 7 year duration fixed income. Really, you know, had a tremendously bad year during the rate hike cycle and some stabilization since then. That's the story there.
So with that, I mean, I realize this is a public meeting, but what's the long-term view on this particular manager?
So within that space, we've migrated. We're adding supplemental managers around this in terms of the treasury exposure. And you know, this is something we're going to continue to reevaluate how that treasury is built. It's a conversation we've had with the investment committee. I understand the full board hasn't been privy to that. But it's something where we say, like, this still has a role. We need to supplement it with other pieces that are going to do this more zigging and zagging. And, you know, we'll see what the allocation looks like going forward. But I think, you know, it's certainly acknowledgement that we're going to have to build some additional pillars around it.
All right. Thank you.
And then I would just highlight our upmarket, downmarket capture here. The acknowledgement here is that you've had a lot of up markets over the past 3 years. There's only been 3 quarters that were down. I think in those 3 quarters, we offered some decent protection there. But, you know, with a more defensively oriented portfolio, there hasn't been a lot of periods where the strengths of the portfolio can really get highlighted here. So I'd say this is largely in keeping with expectations. We would expect the upmarket capture to be better. The reason it's not, again, goes back to private equity not delivering over this past 3 year period. That's really the story there. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions from the trustees.
All right, thank you, Tim. Any further questions for Tim on his report? Candace, anything from you?
No, all interesting stuff.
Thank you. All right, that's great. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Scott and Danny. We'll move on from that item. Move on to